Hello, and welcome to Spilling the DPT mini-season. I'm your main host, Dr. Ryan McConnell, an assistant professor at Belmont University's Physical Therapy Program. And over these next several weeks, we will be showcasing our talented students as they deliver solid interview styles on PT hot topics surrounding management and strategic planning. So sit back, listen, and enjoy.
Hi, this is Jonathan Lee here at Belmont University talking to Chris Wolf, who teaches orthopedics here at Belmont and runs his own cash-based business focused on treating endurance athletes here in Nashville. So without further ado, here is the rapport wizard, Chris Wolf.
It's quite the sound machine for the audience we have there in the background.
I have a really versatile soundboard ready to go at all times.
That's fantastic.
So did I miss anything in the introduction?
I appreciate that. That's always a humbling experience when you're being introduced and see somebody else's kind of take on summarizing everything you've done for the past several years in a few sentences.
Yeah, we try to keep it short and sweet. Otherwise, you could be here all day. So we're trying to focus on building rapport and trust with patients today. So relative to that, can you talk about how you started your own private practice and how that kind of tied into how you got here today?
Mm-hmm. Totally. So I've been in private practice now for 3 years, a little over 3 years. I started that beginning of September 2017. And I did that after being in outpatient orthopedic sports medicine for a little over 10 years. So I think now if you start doing the math, I graduated from physical therapy school in December of 2006. Started practicing February 21st, 2007. And then I left. I was with the same company and kind of on like a regional director and partnership with that company for over a decade. And I was blessed to be able to start to manage multiple clinics for them, kind of on an outpatient basis and sports medicine basis, and then decided to branch off and to do my own practice in 2017. And that was kind of like a work in progress. I decided to do that in December of 16, and it took me about 7 to 8 months to really get things lined up so I could do that.
So what made you make that move?
That's a beautiful question. And a question that I'll try to be respectful of your time, because I could, you know, we could go into lunch discussing that. What made me make that decision, we can start philosophically or we could talk clinically, and I'll start kind of philosophically, because as I was consulting with a lot of important people, those much smarter than me, because that's the key to success. So always surround yourself by people smarter than yourself. I was told that when the pain of staying the same supersedes the pain of making a change, then you're ready to make a change. And so a lot of people can have an idea of doing something, can have a dream of doing something, but they really won't ever act on that until the pain of not doing it or staying where you're at stays less than the pain or the fear of making that jump. So I got to the point where in December, at a particular date in December, I leaned over to my wife and I said, it's time for a change. Because we've been discussing that for a while, and I had positioned myself where I wanted to be able to deliver a particular style of care and be able to take what I could deliver in our beautiful profession as a physical therapist to a much higher level. And in order for me to do that, I needed to change the setting in which I delivered that.
So what is it about rapport and patient trust that has been crucial to your practice and your outcomes, especially when you started?
So rapport with patients is something that I hold And it's probably the biggest thing that I probably begin a conversation with and I end it with. And those who surround me and know me know that I spend a lot of time and I concentrate on the rapport that you build with somebody. And that was something that I was introduced to much later. That fell into that. It's not unique to me by any means. And as I was introduced to that, and I educated myself on that, and I was educated on that throughout the many, many years, I found that the statistics and the research that's out there is very, very true. That it is for the majority of the time, it doesn't matter if you're a novice clinician, and a novice clinician is somebody that's defined as 5 years or less coming out of school, or you are a seasoned clinician, the statistics show that you're typically going to be about 80% successful in getting somebody better. And as they start to break that down, then that kind of starts up a whole new conversation of, does it really matter then how skilled or what certification somebody has or what way somebody else treats versus somebody else, how somebody else treats. Majority of the time, when the brass tacks, when it comes down to it, statistics show that you're going to be able to get about 80% of your population about 80% better, which is great. That at least you're in the positive bit. I was very interested, though, in digging more into that 20%. And what statistics and studies show now is that the extra 20% are nonspecifics. And nonspecifics mean that in PT school and in how most people treat, we get lost into physical assessments, we get lost into special tests, we get lost into exercise prescription and programming, and very kind of black and white treatment styles. And if you fall into that, then you will get about 80% of your patients better, especially as long as you don't get in the way of natural healing, because our bodies want to naturally heal. So as long as you don't get in the way of that, and then you're able to implement what we know, then you're going to be about 80% successful. I was very interested in knowing how to accelerate that, and I wanted to know what is missing. And that is known as like the nonspecifics. And the nonspecifics are when you have to go outside of how's this person physically look? What's their strength, range of motion loss, special tests? What's the tissue damage, something like that? And you start to look at what is stressful in this person's life? What is this person's prior belief structure? What's their past injury history? And what are their thoughts on that? What's their sleep cycle like? What's their nutritional cycle? Like their nutritional habits, what are those like? What is their fear-based avoidance that they're thinking about right now? Are they in the middle of a pandemic right now? Have they just lost their job right now? So those are all the non-specifics that go into someone's true health and their health care. And again, this is not unique to me, but when you start digging into the non-specifics of health, those play such a huge role in whether somebody will get better or not. And the skill that then you can layer in on top of that from what you can provide, like the knowledge that you have of how to actually physically help somebody get better, is not separate. And it's not the fact that you can actually build a rapport and figure out and dig deep into someone's life and figure out where they're at. It's not one or the other, it's both. It's and. If you can combine that with a really high level of knowledge and skill set of just musculoskeletal information or neurological layering in pain science, all of that, then you are positioning yourself to be very successful. And then you step out of this kind of role that so many times we have adopted as health practitioners, where we are the physician and the patient is coming to us and looking for us for all the answers. And if you adopt this mindset, then you step into more of what they call like a true patient alliance standpoint, where you're almost having like a brainstorming session with your patient, as opposed to saying, you tell me why you're here, or you tell me what is on the sheet of paper, what you're diagnosed with, and I will tell you what to do. And that just doesn't work. And that shouldn't work. because there's so many layers of information about someone's condition and their life that you need to truly enter into a conversation and actually have an alliance with that person and then have a brainstorming session and then come to the conclusion together. Because we know that somebody will actually believe and stay compliant with what they hear themselves say versus what they hear somebody else says. And so if you can get somebody to actually voice and say what needs to be said, then you're already more than halfway there with getting them already bought in, their compliance with knowing the change, instead of just being told what to do. So when you look at that, building a rapport with somebody is so valuable because you know that your success pretty much hangs on your ability to connect with somebody and of their background, understanding that, and the success of the outcome.
I love that. So do you have like a good example of maybe a patient or either earlier on where you struggled with this or recently where you knocked it out of the park where they came in looking for help, maybe you were the fifth person they've seen in regards to something and you were the person to dig deep and get them to change, you know, take them from that 20% who didn't get better and bring them back over.
So an example, I can give you a couple different examples where probably one of the first times that it kind of resonated with me how important this was. And many times the information is always there. It's just whether or not we have positioned ourselves to like truly listen, right? And truly see it and truly be an observer, as opposed to just saying like, oh yeah, yeah, I never knew that that's really what I was kind of being told. So when I was in a normal practice setting and a normal clinical setting, and the difficult part was when you have a lot of things going on, a lot of patients moving around, a lot of clinicians moving around, you've got music on, you got the TV going, you got people exercising, there's a lot of like extraneous noise, and I'm totally fine with that. Like I thrive on like atmosphere, and I can pick up energy, and I thrive on the energy that surrounds me, and I can usually be a good input for that as well. But the difficult part is being able to remove yourself from that and not be distracted. And so when you're trying to truly connect with somebody, the difference between me making good eye contact with that person and then truly giving them the impression that at that moment right now, there's nothing else more important than them. And with everything else going on and all the noise and all the stuff, and I had to remove myself from trying to answer an email, a work email, or catch up on the previous person's notes, or try to dictate and type what that person is actually saying right then, so that way I don't get snowed under by notes by the end of the day. And all of those distractions, and this person is trying to tell me that I'm their second or third therapist that they're seeing, and they're trying to avoid a surgery for a lumbar disc herniation. And they had fallen, unfortunately, prey to very quick conversations with the practitioners they had interacted with before, and they had fallen prey to being interrupted multiple times as they were just trying to tell their story. They had been, again, fallen prey to the fact that they were kind of be rushed to a surgical outcome, and nobody had really taken the time to listen to them. And so at that moment, things kind of aligned for me where I picked up on the person's body language, I picked up on how they were kind of presenting themselves, and I was able to, at least at that moment, to be intuitive enough to kind of push things aside. There's so many non-specifics that go into it as well. Like I let them sit in it on the table. They felt comfortable doing that. I maintained eye contact. I sat in a lower chair so they didn't feel like I was kind of towering over them. Mm-hmm. And I maintained eye contact with them. And we literally sat there and talked for like 55 minutes. I was blessed at that moment to have an hour blocked off. And so I spent the majority of that time letting them talk and tell me their story for 55 minutes. And by the end of that, and I would ask maybe an occasional follow-up question, but I really just let them talk and I just gained information. And they literally said, this is the first time anyone's actually ever just listened to me and talk about this. And I feel so good about this. And as I was asking certain questions and just pertinent questions for them, the treatment that I was able to give them, again, I was limited on time. And I kind of told the person, okay, I'm limited on time right now, what we can do. But because I was able to kind of understand where they were coming from, we talked about a treatment intervention, more of just education for about 5 minutes. And then we lined up a follow-up visit for that. And that resonated so well with that person. That person came to me multiple times as we attempted to help get them better. I was able to kind of go with that person to a couple different stores to look at kind of some lumbar support and back support. And I realized that I was building a good alliance with this patient on a very professional level, but they ended up having a really great and wonderful outcome. And when I saw that, that resonated with me a lot. That doesn't happen all the time, but that's an example of things kind of going well. Things not going well is when I've been in a situation where I am distracted and trying to do other things and not giving the patient my full attention, and you miss such key aspects of what the person's trying to tell you. Because it's so is true that somebody, your patient doesn't want to hide information from you. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to like make it like a test question, yeah, where they're trying to weave in a paragraph. You're like, ah, ha, ha, I see where you're trying to lead me down this road, but I'm not going to fall for it. You know, they're not trying to do that. They're truly there to try to get better and truly be
that's
helped.
That's why they're there.
That's why they've sought you out. So I think that's the biggest time. I've had countless examples of where you feel like at the end of the day, when you reflect back, do you feel like you really gave that person your 100% attention, or did you feel distracted?
Yeah.
And were you able to make a connection with that person? And then truly see and treat where they are that day and not go in with a biased decision of, well, this is what I had planned for. Mm-hmm. This is what we did last time. So we must have a linear progression of treatment, as opposed to saying, how are you doing today? What else is going on? And have the flexibility to punt on what you had already designed, and then truly sit down and talk with the person,
yeah,
more so than that. And as I kind of reflect back on that throughout my history, there were key pieces of information that people have always been trying to teach me about that. Again, it just took me a while to kind of really figure that out and listen to that. And again, I'll give you one more example. What that looks like now, it's now where I design my time in my clinical practice where I don't have any other distractions. I spend one-on-one time with my patient. I try to control the variables as much as I can. But that alliance takes the standpoint of my very first question, mm-hmm, to them when they come in and sit with me. If we have a mutual connection, or maybe I know them before, you know, we always do kind of the initial icebreakers of trying to catch up and things like that. But then when it comes down to it, I just simply ask them, like, how can I help them? I don't try to lead them biasly, like, I hear you're here, you've come to see me for this. I don't try to do that anymore. I just try to literally meet them where they're at and ask them. And now my note-taking during my practice is where I typically, I look at them in the eyes if they feel comfortable keeping eye contact. Some, mm-hmm, people don't, so I just try to be respectful of that. And I just listen, because if I'm giving them my sole attention, I won't forget key pieces of information. If there's a pretty involved history, or at some point in the conversation we're trying to summarize things, I usually use a whiteboard, and I give them a marker, I take a marker, and now we actually write on the whiteboard their timeline and their symptoms. And I would say that was most beneficial for a very successful marathon runner that has aspirations to being on the Olympic team, mm-hmm, for US. And as we dug into her past medical history, she was a great historian, and she started reaching back in like 2012, 2013 from a start of history. And we started timelining that on the marker board, and it turned, by the end of that, the whole marker board was full of information. And we were both at the end of that sitting side by side on a table, staring at it together. And she said, this is so powerful. Because not only does this help paint a picture for me that I didn't even make connections on, but I almost see like how resilient I am and how that I have come back and bounced back from so much. She goes, I feel better already. And we literally just written out what she her just her history. It was the first time we had actually put it out in front of her. I was asking pertinent questions and really just letting her kind of tell it. And that's really just what solidified to me. It was like, man, this is really what this is about. And then from there, that took an hour. That took an hour to do that. And I so love the way that I've been blessed to set things up now, because I knew it was going to be someone involved, and I still had an hour for treatment for her because I was able to block off that time. And I know that's not realistic all the time, but not feeling like you can rush through that initial rapport building time with her or with any patient is so important.
So that's a really good point, because a lot of our new grads who are getting ready to enter the workforce, going on rotations, or novice clinicians are just trying to survive through the weight of the responsibilities for documentation, whatever their patient load is. So do you feel like your specific practice, the way you've built it, is what allows you to do that? Or do you think there are opportunities for that kind of engagement to occur in a more standard clinic setting?
That's a great question. It's probably $1 million question right there. I had to leave my current level of practice and enter into the way I've got it designed now in order to be able to really figure out how to do that. There are great clinicians out there that can work in a very kind of busy setting and still build rapport and a connection with somebody. And that is still possible. You have to be very aware every day and check yourself to make sure that you're not falling into this kind of tunnel of, okay, I see everything as a task to be done, a checklist to get knocked off, and I'm going to try to move this patient through as quickly as possible. Because it's very easy to do that.
Yeah.
It's very easy to start to fall into that mindset where you're like, all right, I'm going to classify this person as a simple diagnosis, and thank goodness that it's a simple diagnosis because I can blow through this pretty easily. And you'll miss being able to truly connect with the non-specifics. And then you are relying a lot on just kind of personality at that point, where you're like, well, I'm a likable person. The person likes me because I'm a likable person. I'm easy to get along with, right? And you're like, I'm naturally a good conversationalist, and I can smile at the person, and I have a good warm demeanor, and the person just likes me. And then if I can be somewhat skillful and help them come along, then things will probably work out for the best. So that's use those to your advantage. I would say, and it's not a bad thing. You know, we all have certain assets we bring to the table, and so you need to learn those, what you do bring to the table well. So use those to your advantage, and then just always ask yourself, like, are you taking full advantage of the ability to truly connect and help somebody? It's emotionally draining at times, and you have to be careful about that, because if you try to pour yourself into multiple people the entire day, sometimes you have to put a barrier up so you cannot take on all of that from somebody, because that can be draining. And that's what you have to sometimes be careful about. So sometimes it's easier just to kind of stiff arm everybody. You're like, no, I'll keep everybody at a distance. My patients, I won't be able to try to dig in too deep with them. So that's a difficult question to answer. Yes, it is possible. I think as I've tried to learn how to do that on a very slowed down role, the only way I knew the importance of doing that is because I was able to try to implement it in a normal, busier clinical practice. Mm-hmm. And then I knew what it would take to take it to a different level, where I've been trying to kind of experiment with it and learn it. And that way I can pass that on to other people and say, hey, this is what I've learned. This is how you can do this. And this is how you can implement it in any type of setting.
So you talk about having a sunny disposition and being a personable guy who can just start building that relationship, which I think there's a lot of PTs who just have that element of positivity to create some groundwork. But besides that, just in a busy setting, what are the most consistent factors that you can think of that either you use or you've seen other people use in those settings, so that way we can take these little chunks of your bigger, broader plan and vision, how you do things,
and implement it.
Take that into a smaller package.
Yeah. So I would say the interaction that starts in the very beginning and to the next day. And I'll explain a little bit of that. So where do you start from the very beginning is literally by your body language and how you communicate to that person when you welcome them into your practice setting, your house of rehab, from the very beginning, from the waiting room. Okay, designing the way that your whole practice looks, because people will start having biases based off the cleanliness, the neatness, really the placebo effects of walking into a practice and feeling, I can get better here. That right there speaks volumes. You know, like my practice setting right now doesn't have a very clinical feel to it, and I love that.
Yeah.
When I walk in and people see me now, they walk in, they're like, oh, people get really strong here. People move here. This isn't where this whole clinic is filled with tables and modalities where I'm going to lay down, I expect somebody to do stuff for me. It's like, no, Chris is going to walk me past multiple weight racks and exercise equipment to go to a table where we're going to sit there and talk for a little bit. So I use that placebo effect to my advantage, because that tells people, oh, I work here. We're going to work out. We're going to get stronger here. So it gives a sense, and the people who have to walk past are working really hard and they're having an enjoyable time.
Yeah.
And they're like, that alone is like, this feels good. This feels right. So thinking about your setting, thinking about those that are in that setting, and if you have power to help control that atmosphere, super important.
So that first impression is really
so important.
What you're trying to cultivate.
Do you actually come and greet your person, or do you yell to them across from the room and scream to them to come back to you? Right? I know that sounds kind of far-fetched, but not really. I used to have a clinician that worked in my practice with me, and you could almost see her eyeballs rolling in the back of her head when her patient walked in, and she would kind of just like yell from them from across the room and then come back. So, yeah, I know it sounds far-fetched, but that's maybe to an extreme. So the fact that you actually welcome them in, greet them, come back, use the atmosphere to your advantage, okay, or whatever atmosphere you're trying to convey. Mm-hmm. And then think about where they're at that point. Do they feel comfortable making eye contact? Do they feel like they're in a nervous state? Are they in a relaxed state? Are they in a closed-off state? Do they feel like something's on their mind? So be perceptive. And then ask very open-ended questions. And so in a close setting, ask them what they're here for. And then stop talking. No, you know, and if you book in the amount of time that you have with that person, like a beginning and end, say, I'm so glad you're here. I've really designed this time. We've got about 20 minutes of uninterrupted time right now before I'll have somebody come in where I probably need to welcome and greet them and get them going. But for the next X amount of time, and maybe it's in the busier setting, for the next 10 minutes, I want to have a focused time with you. So now you've kind of bookend an expectation. And now when you're like, hang on 1 minute, I've interrupted you because I got to go jump over here. It doesn't seem like it's unplanned. They know. Okay, let's get down to business now, because now I know I've got 10 minutes of uninterrupted time. And they've stated that. And then hold true to that. I would say then follow that all the way through the next day. After we finish talking today, I'm going to jump on the phone with two patients, brand new patients I saw yesterday. They don't know I'm going to call them. But one of them does, one of them doesn't. But I'm going to do a follow-up phone call to them. I may or may not get them on the phone. But I may leave a voicemail. And that's my follow-up to them, checking in on how they're doing from the time we spent together yesterday. Because that continues the rapport of saying, I've been thinking about you. I am still thinking about you. I care about what your outcomes are. And I'm taking the time to follow up with you via the phone. In fact, I'm doing it via phone instead of just a text or an email, where that could be almost auto-populated. Mm-hmm. And I get to answer any of the questions for you.
Yeah, have an actual conversation.
Yeah, and that can usually take a minute, 30 seconds. And most of the time that's not done because of the time it takes. Mm-hmm. But again, if you book in that with, I wanted to take 1 to 2 minutes and follow up with you. So you've basically given, again, the beginning and end of that expectation of what's the purpose of this phone call. I didn't block off 30 minutes or another hour.
Yeah.
I blocked off 1 to 2 minutes. I just wanted to check in and see how you were doing.
How often do you think that happens?
Rarely. Maybe 3% of the time.
Yeah. So that's the first time I've really heard anyone talk to following up by phone on a consistent basis with more than, I don't know, maybe one patient a month for something that has caught them off guard. Scheduling outside of that. So at this point, how important is it to have a good front desk staff? Or do you have a front desk staff? Does that build into your rapport?
I do not have like a front desk or a clerical worker or like a point contact person as of right now. When I started the practice, I started it with just myself. I was in a setting, entered into a setting where there was multiple people there, but I don't have anybody fielding those initial conversations for me or ending them. I was initial point of contact. I'm the last point of contact. And I'm going to fight really, really hard to try to maintain that as things continue to build. Right now, we've been able to grow. There's 3 clinicians now, and then we'll actually have a 4th one in the next couple months. And as our staff continues to grow, we fight really hard to take what we've learned right now and start to implement that on as things continue to kind of start building a little bit bigger. There's just, again, the first point of contact and the last person somebody sees or hears from will kind of make or break how successful your outcomes will be a lot of times, the interaction. So that person that you have positioned to be the first person and the last person that somebody meets needs to be somebody special, needs to be somebody very special. And most of the time, they're very underpaid.
Yeah, that's I used to work at front desk, and I was fortunate to be paid fairly well, but I've also heard and seen some other situations where they were asked to deliver the world.
Just so many times it's so easy to look at like non-clinical providers, and you think, yes, everyone's replaceable, but not everyone's expendable. And the times we don't see the necessity again of enriching that interaction from the very first person and the last person. And that could be an entire, probably different podcast from providing education information on that.
So I think one of the last questions,
yes,
we could have to wrap up is, you have a door CV in your clinic.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that to getting people to like buy in to your brand of therapy? Is it something that helps say, hey, this guy has got the cutting edge stuff and he knows how to use it and help me get better? Or is it something that you say, yeah, I have this, but we don't need this for you. We're going to focus on you right now. Like, what's the balance for that?
Yeah, that's... Thank you for asking that question that way. That's actually a great question. My thought process of that has definitely evolved. It's so easy to fall in the trap of we all like shiny new things, right? Having 2 children and watching them being and chasing shiny new things, apparently it's ingrained in us as children. But it's also really easy to get caught up into the newest thing. And data, being driven by data. And if you're in like a field of medicine, well, we love that. But I go to my accountant because she's great at what she does, mm-hmm. and not because she has the newest accounting software. I don't care what type of software she has. I care that the fact that she is somebody that has some real conversation with me, and she's a wonderful accountant, and her outcomes are spectacular. That's why I stick with my same accountant. So if I implement that on the side of how I provide treatment, the same data that she gets from fancy software doesn't mean anything unless she is skilled enough to interpret it. And so a lot of fancy new stuff that we like to get really doesn't, all the information it spits out does nothing to tell somebody what to do with that information. Right. And it kind of goes back to when I finally put that piece together of what I talked about before, is a ton of treatment has to be built into the non-specifics. Non-specifics is not spit out via data. So if you can have data applied to that and know how to interpret it and know how to really attach that to non-specifics and a rapport with the person and know the person so well, it helps out so much. So anyway, DorsaV, again, running technology that provides a little bit of data that I would say the majority of the time I don't have to help somebody get better. Mm-hmm. Does that provide a little bit of a different layer that I like to have that helps to kind of enrich things? Totally. Have I been getting people better with and without that for a long time? Yes. And do I put somebody on that? How quickly do I put somebody on that? When I know that the data I'm going to see there is truly accurate. If I've made a good connection with that person rapport, I don't need that to bring that person in. People don't come to see me because I have a DorsaV, because DorsaV is not that expensive, and you can buy that by jumping online. So I try to always keep that in mind, that we try not to get lost in those little bitty specifics. Because, and I'll say this, and then I'll pass the mic back to you. We're dealing with runners and endurance athletes, which is a huge passion of mine, and that's really what I've kind of built my practice initially on, and now we've been able to layer a lot of other different styles of practice on top of that. But that's truly my personal passion. Working with running-related injuries, 64% of running-related injuries are due to poor programming. So 64%, which means that I've got 36% truly due to a weakness or loss of range of motion and flexibility and the data that certain things would tell me. Mm-hmm. 36%. So if I can actually understand this person, where they're coming from, understand their background, understand their programming, understand what they've done for the last several months, if I just knew that and knew how to interpret that, I'd have a 64% rate of getting that person better without even getting off the table or getting off the whiteboard. So now knowing that, I'm like, Then how much time do I spend there before I jump to my special tests and my strength assessment and all that? So do I spend 64% of the time actually understanding all of that first? So
your favorite tool might be your whiteboard.
I would say my favorite tool is my ability to have a conversation. I use the whiteboard to help my patient kind of see it and conceptualize it.
Yeah, I love it. So, as we wrap up, what would be the one thing you would want listeners to take away from this conversation and some advice to upcoming graduates who are about to leave 2020 and enter 2021?
Yeah. Biggest advice is that you spend a lot of time learning a specific skill set that definitely needs to be developed and truly learned and learned how to implement that. And that will take time. It will take probably 0 to 5 years to learn how to implement that very, very well. And if you're able to focus and give yourself designated time to spend the time focusing on that skill set for 5 years, then you can step out of that novicehood. Mm-hmm. If you can layer in finding a mentor to teach you not only a skill set, but also some of the non-specifics we're talking about, you'll probably actually reach there a lot quicker. And then don't lose track of the importance of building in how to truly interview somebody. Motivational interviewing, having a conversation, knowing what pertinent information to ask, knowing how to listen, truly how to build a rapport with somebody. That takes time to develop as well, and there's a certain confidence with that as well. But if you can start to learn that, and at the same time you're working on your physical skill set and things, then you will be head and shoulders above, unfortunately, so much of the medical staff and personnel out there.
Wonderful, thank you. I'd shake your hand, but It's COVID time.
We're social distancing right now. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having a great conversation today.
So thank you, Chris Wolf, for coming here today.
And that's all for this episode of Spilling the DPT. We'll look forward to spilling with y'all next time. And if you don't mind, in the meantime, drop us a rating and a comment. And we'll look forward to you tuning in next time.